From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Larry David speaks with our contributor, Dave Davies.
Are you saying I'm too broad, Dave?
No.
Is that what I'm getting here?
I'm asking you to talk about your arch.
Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld and the creator and star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, wrote and stars in the new Broadway play, Fish in the Dark.
It's not so easy, Dave. First of all, it's a lot of pressure. You know, you got to make 1,000 people laugh every night with a script. It's not like doing stand-up.
Today, David talks about his early stand-up and how it led to co-creating Seinfeld, and he'll compare his own personality with the character he played on his HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by trumpeter Eddie Henderson, who is also a medical doctor, and Maureen Carrigan reviews the new novel by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Larry David, co-created Seinfeld and created the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm, in which he starred as a selfish, self-absorbed, misanthropic character named Larry David. The real Larry David is very popular in New York right now. He wrote and stars in a new play, which opens tonight, and it's broken Broadway's all-time record for advance ticket sales, more than $14 million. The play is called Fish in the Dark, and it's a comedy about the rivalries and dysfunction of a family as its patriarch passes away. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies saw a preview performance of Fish in the Dark, and on Monday, he recorded an interview with Larry David. They started with a scene from a preview performance set at a family gathering after the father has died. His widow, played by Jane Houdyshell, is startled by something she's seen. We also hear her two sons, played by Ben Schenkman and Larry David.
Cindy! Cindy! Cindy, what's here? Cindy, what's here?
Mama, calm down. What is it?
It's a bird out there. You didn't see it? It was right there.
So what?
It was an Oriole. Daddy was from Baltimore. He was an Oriole fan. That was a sign from Cindy. He said he would give me a sign, and that was it.
Mama, you're crazy? They'll put you in the nut house. Just a bird.
It wasn't a bird. It was Sydney.
So I don't understand. What if it was Dad? Is that a good thing? Dad's a bird? Dad's a bird. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Sydney. What a freak show.
Well, Larry David, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us where the idea for this play came from.
Well, Dave, I have a friend. His name is Lloyd Braun. And his father died, and he started telling me about it. And to the twisted mind, it actually seemed like it was a funny, the whole incident seemed very funny to me, how it was unfolding. And I thought this could be a play. And 2 weeks later, I actually started, I sat down and started writing.
You play the lead in the play, and I gather that was not your intent originally, right?
Don't remind me.
So how did you thought of someone else at the role? Anybody in particular?
Anyone in particular. Anyone except me. Uh-huh. I got roped in. The producer, Scott Rudin, said, "This sounds like you. You have to do this." And, of course, it did sound like me, the main character. So I don't know. I thought, well, I wonder what that'll be like to do something like this. And now I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, and?
It's not so easy, Dave. It's not so easy.
No, well, it certainly doesn't look easy to me. And you had not been on stage since you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
So what was hard about it?
First of all, it's a lot of pressure. And you got to make 1,000 people laugh every night with a script. It's not like doing stand-up. It's just something, it was something new for me. I never did it before, and it's definitely a challenge.
You know, people talk about taking themselves out of their comfort zone for a new challenge.
Yeah.
Was it that kind of thing for you? Because it sounds like you sure did.
Yeah, if you even have a comfort zone. Whatever comfort zone I had was pretty narrow. But this was definitely out of it for sure. Yeah.
You know, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, as I understand it, most of the dialogue was pretty much improvised. You would give all the actors an outline and then you'd improvise it. This must be very different working from a script. Was that hard?
Yeah, it is different. It's completely different. I have total freedom on Curb to kind of say and do anything I want. I can follow every impulse that I have, and I'm allowed to interject when other people are talking. I'm kind of writing the scene as we're doing it, but this play is a different animal. You have lines. There are cues that are very important. If you just screw up one line, you're off track, and it's hard to get back on. You have to abide by the script, and the other actors don't like it if you get off of it either.
Right, they're counting on the cues and your timing.
Yeah, by the way, so am I. I'll be completely thrown.
You know, when you were doing Curb Your Enthusiasm, so much of the comedy came from the facial expressions, which you got in close-ups. I mean, this is a completely different kind of animal. Just talk a little bit about that. Is it a matter of giving the same kind of expression in a broader, more physical way?
Are you saying I'm too broad, Dave?
No.
Is that what I'm getting here?
I'm asking you to talk about your art.
you know what? I haven't really changed a lot of my so-called technique, even though there are, as you said, no close-ups or anything like that. I'm making the same stupid faces that I would normally make. Probably. I could tell when I get reactions from a glance or, just some kind of reaction that I'm making. I know when the audience is amused by it.
Do you do any vocal exercises before you start the play?
No, I probably should. I saw a bunch of the other actors on stage the other night, and they were warming up, and it just seemed like a silly exercise to me. they do things with their lips. They do that, and they stretch their mouths and do scales, but no.
There are a lot of really veteran theater actors in the cast. I mean, some really great performers. And
yes, it's a great cast.
It is. And I wonder if there are things about just theater culture that you've noticed and been surprised or intimidated or anything by.
Well, there are some superstitions they have. Like, you're not allowed to whistle in the theater. And of course, I've whistled a number of times because I'm an inveterate whistler, and I just always seem to forget. And boy, oh boy, do I get some bad looks when I do that.
They mean it.
From some of the vets, they don't like that one bit.
We're speaking with Larry David. He wrote and stars in the new Broadway play Fish in the Dark. When I told my wife I was going to be interviewing you, she says, I want to know how that guy got the way he is. And, of course, she's assuming that guy is the guy she's seen on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
That doesn't sound so good to me.
Well,
How am I? I'd like to ask your wife, and yes, and how am I? What is this that you're seeing?
Well, it's the guy on Curb Your Enthusiasm, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
And we'll talk about whether that's how close that is to the real Larry David. But I do want you to tell us about where you grew up. You grew up in Brooklyn. Tell us about the neighborhood.
I grew up in Brooklyn in in Sheepshead Bay. I lived right under the Belt Parkway, and there were four buildings, which was my little universe. My friends, my five, six, seven, eight friends, we all lived in this building. And it was a very happy childhood as far as I remember. We played sports all the time, walked to school, came home from school, played ball. In the winter, we'd play basketball in freezing temperatures. And for every possible, we would invent games. And not too many girls in my life, I must say, though.
and what did your parents do?
My father was in the clothing business. He was a salesman. And my mother worked for the Bureau of Child Guidance.
As a social worker?
No, I think she did secretarial work.
Uh-huh. And did you have extended family in the neighborhood or in the building?
I did. I had aunts and my aunt and uncle and my cousins were right next door. My grandmother and my uncle and my cousin were on the third floor. So there was no privacy. People were running in and out of the house all the time. Everybody knew your business. And then we also had relatives on Long Island where we'd go and see what the how rich people live. Now, we at the time, I thought they were rich because they didn't live in Brooklyn. I mean, yeah, they really weren't rich. They just lived in a house. To me, anybody who lived in a house was rich.
And there was all this, as you said, family interaction and chaos around you. Did you see humor in it at the time? Did you make friends laugh?
No, I wasn't funny at all. I didn't even suspect that I had a sense of humor until I went to college. And then something kind of changed. I don't know what happened. Perhaps it was meeting new friends and being in a different environment that unleashed something in me. I don't know.
Did you have any sense of your future back then? Do you remember?
Just whatever it was, in my head, it was bleak. I don't remember having any ambitions, any goals, any dreams. It was always, how am I going to get by? What am I going to do? But I didn't really, to be honest, I didn't really give it much thought. Even in college, I didn't give it much thought. I was having fun in college, and basically when people asked me what I was going to do, I just said, something will turn up. What that was, I had no idea.
And did your parents have any particular expectation?
Zero. Zero expectations. My mother, I've said this before, she wanted me to work in the post office. She wanted me to be a mailman because she thought, I'd get a pension and I'd be taken care of. I would have security. And that was her dream. That was the best case scenario, that I would be a mailman.
You were going to be Newman.
I was going to be Newman, exactly. Newman was very happy.
Steady work. You got a health
plan. Right. Newman is one of the happiest guys on television. Come on.
Right. He knows who he likes and who he doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah, and the hours were good.
Right.
You know, they just dropped some mail off. It seemed like a decent job.
How did your parents react to your success?
They were quite stunned by it. When Seinfeld was the number one show in the country, my mother would call me up and go, Larry, do they like you? Do they think you're doing a good job? Are they going to keep you? What do they say to you? Do they tell you you're good? She was very insecure.
As I read about, your early life, one of the things that occurred to me is that, I grew up in a family. My parents didn't go to college. None of the people in my neighborhood went to college. And, I kind of managed to make a career and get on the radio, and I've been lucky enough to do the show from time to time and talk to people like you. But there's still a part of me that kind of doesn't believe in it. And people that I know that grew up in families where they were wealthy or their parents were public figures or university professors, they're just more comfortable out in the world and accepting that they are somebody. And I wonder, even after all you've accomplished, do you feel like you belong on the red carpet and, in magazines?
Not really. I completely understand what you're saying. It is a little odd. I'm somewhat detached from it. Like I'll see my name on the marquee and it doesn't really kind of register in any way. So I'm disassociated from it. But occasionally I do feel like a jerk. What am I doing here? Walking on the red carpet. These people obviously don't know me.
We're speaking with Larry David. He wrote and stars in the new Broadway play, Fish in the Dark. How did you get into comedy? You said you were in college having fun, no thought of a particular future.
Yeah, then I got out of college and I was funny with my friends, and my friend's wife said to me, you should be a comedian. And I thought, really? It just hadn't occurred to me. And then I went to the improvisation, to watch a show. And as I'm watching the show, I'm starting to think that, hey, maybe Jane's right. Maybe I could do this. In fact, not only am I starting to think I could do it, I think I could be really funny up there. Not only that, I'm going to go up there right now. I go up to the owner of the club, Bud Friedman, and I say, I'd like to go on. Now, I'm just sitting in the audience on a Saturday night. I leave my seat, and I go talk to the owner, and I say to the owner of the club that I want to go on. And this is probably the most insane thing I've ever done in my life. And he said to me, who are you? I said, I'm just sitting in the audience. He said, no, you can't go on. Are you a comedian? I said, no. He said, no, you have to audition, and then if you pass the audition, then you could start going on. So thank God he said no, because had he said yes and I had gone up, it would have been a disaster. I may never walked up on a stage again for the rest of my life. But I started to put an act together, and then I went down to the Village, to a place called Gertie's Folk City, and I did. I got on stage for the first time. A week later, I went to Gil Hodges Bowling Alley in Brooklyn and got on stage for the second time. And then for the third time, I went to Catch a Rising Star, and I passed the audition, and then I started working out at Catch a Rising Star.
Well, you know, we have a little piece of tape, and this is from Susie Essman, your friend, who, of course, appeared on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And she was at an appearance, and she was recalling her early days with you in stand-up. Let's listen.
Larry was a comic. Larry started as a stand-up comic, and I knew him from Catch a Rising Star. We probably met in 1985, 1986. And he was a legendary. He's what we call a comedian's comedian, meaning that he would get on stage and the comedians would stand in the back of the room. And Larry's on. We'd all come running into the room to watch him because you knew something brilliant and original was going to happen. But the audience half the time stared at him like they had no idea what the hell he was talking about. And he was very, very touchy. You know, sometimes if like the whole audience is laughing and you had a stomach ache and had a bad look on your face, that would be it. He'd storm off the stage. You know, or one time I remember I introduced him and, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Larry David, and he came on the stage and he just looked at the audience and he just went, never mind. And he just walked off. Just walked off. But his material was brilliant. He just never figured out that other thing of how to connect to an audience. That wasn't his thing.
And that's Susie Essman talking about our guest Larry David and his early days in stand-up. So does she have it right?
She's, that was pretty accurate. Yeah.
Do you remember the time you came in, looked at the audience, and walked off?
Yes, I do. I didn't say never mind. I think I said, I don't think so.
And why? I mean, what was it about the audience?
I didn't like the looks of them. I didn't like how they responded to the comic who was on before me, and I just didn't see that it was going to be a successful outing. So I decided to do a preemptive attack.
You're not going to let them reject you. You're going to reject them.
Exactly.
You know, when I heard this story and when I read about, I mean, have you struggled with stand-up and how all the comedians loved you, but audiences didn't always connect. And, you know, when you talk to people in show business, so many of them say, well, you know, I really want to follow my artistic voice and do interesting work, not just do what any schlock that's commercially successful. And when I look at your career, I mean, it strikes me that you actually did do that. I mean, you really did stick to what you believed in. And you found these vehicles, and it's an incredible success now because, I mean, it's a particular Larry David way of looking at the world and finding humor in it. And you did stick to your own vision, and it really worked. Is that how you see it?
Well, it didn't seem like I had much of a choice. I don't think that I don't think that my hand would have cooperated with my brain if my brain was telling my hand to write something it didn't really want to write. But I remember when there was some interference from NBC with Seinfeld when we first started doing it, and fortunately I didn't have a family at the time, so it was very easy for me to say to them, "No, I'm quitting. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that, and I can't do it." And for me, it wasn't a big deal to just pack up and go home. Like I said, I didn't have a family. It's much harder. That's the first piece of advice I'll give anybody who wants to get into this. Don't have a family for a while. until you're successful, because it'll just make it very hard to ever get out of things, and you'll always have to compromise. But I didn't have to compromise because I didn't have a family.
And what was it NBC wanted you to do?
You know, they just didn't like the direction of the show. For example, the Chinese restaurant episode.
Right, the whole
hated,
thing.
They,
right.
They hated that show. They didn't even want to air it. And, you know, there was a big meeting about the kind of shows they liked and the kind of shows they didn't like. And, you know, I just said, well, I'm not going to be able to do that. So I just thought that I would quit. But then I learned another lesson, that when you say no, you invariably get your way. And it's a wonderful feeling. I can't believe I never did it before.
No, she's not going to do it.
Yeah, you just say no. And then they go, okay, well, you don't have to.
We're listening to the interview that Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld and the creator and star of the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm. His new play, which he wrote and stars in, opens tonight on Broadway.
You became friends with Jerry Seinfeld doing stand-up together, and that the two of you conceived of the, you know, this incredible hit TV show Seinfeld. And, of course, everybody knows the four characters, and that George Costanza is, I guess, somewhat based on you. Did you ever consider playing that role yourself?
No. It was never mentioned. I never thought of it. Jerry never thought of it. Furthest thing from my mind. And by the way, I couldn't have done it anyway. There's no way that I could have. First of all, they wouldn't have let me do it. But even had they let me do it, there's no way that I could have done that and also I've been the executive producer of the show. It would have been way too hard. I mean, I had a 24/7 job just on the writing end of it and the producing end. So there's no way I could have been in it.
I wonder if you could share a bit of how you talked to Jason Alexander about the character and the role and how you felt about how what he did with it.
First of all, I never even spoke to him about it. We auditioned a number of people to play George, hadn't really found anyone, and then this tape was sent in from New York, and Jerry and I watched the tape, and it was Jason auditioning in New York with a casting director, reading with a casting director, just sitting on a stool. I heard 10 seconds, and I went, "Oh boy, there he is, this guy, this is the guy." And I never had to say one word to him about the character or anything like that. He just had it right from the beginning. He was great. What a fantastic actor. Gave me so many laughs watching him do that.
We're going to play a clip from Seinfeld, and there's a million we could choose, but I thought we would do one of Big Stein, George Steinberg.
Okay.
And, of course, people who know the show will know that there were many episodes where George Costanza worked for the New York Yankees, and he would be occasionally summoned to the office of the famous owner, George Steinbrenner, and you would do the voice. It would be shot from behind another actor, so you didn't actually see him. And this is an episode, I think, in which Steinbrenner has summoned George because he's heard rumors about George's political views.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Steinbrenner?
Yes, George, I did. Come in. George, the word around the office is that you're a communist.
A communist? I am a Yankee, sir, first and foremost.
You know, George, it struck me today that a communist pipeline into the vast reservoir of Cuban baseball talent could be the greatest thing ever to happen to this organization.
Sir?
You could be invaluable to this franchise. George, there's a southpaw down there nobody's been able to get a look at. Something Rodriguez. I don't really know his name. You get yourself down to Havana right away.
Yes, sir. Do my best.
Good. Merry Christmas, George. And bring me back some of those cigars in the cedar boxes. You know, the ones with the fancy rings? I love those fancy rings. They kind of distract you while you're smoking. The red and yellow are nice. It looks good against the brown of the cigar. The Maduro, I like the Maduro wrapper. The darker, the better. That's what I say. Of course, the Claro's good, too. That's more of a pale brown, almost like a milky coffee. I find the ring size very confusing. They have it in centimeters.
And George Costanza has wandered out of the room. That's our guest, Larry David, as the voice of George Steinbrenner. It's funny, as we listen to that, it's not quite your speaking voice. You you did some stuff there with that.
Well, hey, you know, Dave, I was doing an impression.
You're an actor.
Oh, sure. No, we brought in some people to read for Mr. Steinbrenner, and nobody really got it. And Jerry said, "Well, what are you looking for? How does it go?" And all of a sudden, I started talking like this. You know, he's a big blustery guy. He kind of talked like that. And Jerry said, "Yeah, you should do it. That's funny." So that's how that happened.
Uh-huh. Did you ever hear how Steinbrenner himself reacted to the bit?
I think he liked it. Steinbrenner was unfamiliar with the show. His grandchildren watched it, and his grandchildren talked him into letting us use his name. The last episode, I think, of the 96 season, we came up with the idea to actually fly him in and put him on the show. Because up to that point, we'd only been seeing the back of his head, and I was doing his voice. And then we thought it would be fun if he actually made a real appearance. So we called him up, and he said, yeah, he would do it. So we flew out to do it. He did the show. We started editing the show, and as I watched it, I'm going, oh, my God, this is not good. And we thought it's so much better to just see the back of his head with me doing the voice than to actually see the real Steinbrenner, because his acting was wanting, to say the least. So I had to call him up and tell him the news that he was being cut from the show. So I called Yankee Stadium, and I asked to talk to him. And then he got on the phone. I said, Mr. Steinbrenner, this is Larry David calling from the Seinfeld show. And he said, yeah, yes, Larry, what's going on? I said, well, Mr. Steinbrenner, you know, I watched the show. And he said, yeah, you can tell me. I'm a big boy. I said, well, it's not working. We have to cut you from the show. And he was actually okay with it.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Larry David. He wrote and stars in the new play on Broadway, Fish in the Dark. Let's talk a bit about Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I want to begin with a clip. This actually is on the subject of death, which the play is about. In this case, you're walking down the street in Los Angeles and spot your old friend Marty Funkhauser, who's played by Bob Einstein, and his mother has recently died. Let's listen.
Hey! Funkhauser!
My God, I can't believe it. You're out? What are you doing?
This helps my emotions. Jogging is the best thing for me.
So mourners exercise. I didn't know that.
I don't know if mourners exercise. It's just good for me.
Interesting. I'm going to remember that next time I lose a close member of my family.
Yeah. Jogging.
Yeah.
Helps everything.
By the way, I called your house. I left a condolence message. I never got a return call.
Well, I had a few things on my mind.
Yeah, still. It's a little discourteous.
Let me explain something to you.
Sure.
I lost my dad a year ago. My mother just died. I'm an orphan, okay?
A what?
I'm an orphan.
Orphan?
Yeah, an orphan.
You're a little too old to be an orphan.
No, if you don't have parents, you're an orphan.
Oh, you could be 70 and be an orphan?
You could be 100 and be an orphan.
Oh, you can't be 100 and be an orphan.
Yeah, you can.
Okay. Little Orphan Funkhauser.
That's our guest Larry David and Bob Einstein on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes, I'm upset because he didn't respond to my call. He never returned my call.
A little discourteous.
I thought it was discourteous.
When I read about you, your friends say that you are actually a nice and generous person. Does it bother you that you've kind of created this image of yourself as this insensitive jerk?
Oh, God, no, not at all. Why? No, because that's doesn't bother me in the least. I'm quite happy about it. I'm way closer to being the guy on Curb than the guy who's talking to you right now.
Really?
I know I'm often described as a nice guy, but by the way, I think the guy on Curb is a nice guy. He's just very honest.
Okay. Well, the guy on Curb would probably think that the guy on Curb is a nice guy, but I don't know if that many other people would think that.
but why? Why isn't he nice? He's not mean. I don't think he's mean. I think he does nice things.
He just kind of can't let some things go that he might.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't mean he's not nice.
Okay. You know,
I think he's expressing a lot of the things that many people think about.
Right, but just are too inhibited to say.
Exactly.
Right. So are you like that when you're out there? Are you completely uninhibited?
No, I'm completely inhibited. I'm the opposite of him.
Hmm. You know,
that's why it's so much fun to do it.
Like a lot of your friends, Ted Danson has appeared on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And in 2009, he was in an interview on the show with Terry Gross. And she asked if any scenes in the series came out of your actual friendship with one another. And he told a little story. Let's listen to this.
Although when you go out to dinner with him, it's way scarier than acting with him because he's always pulling out his notebook. Or you don't know whether or not he's doing a scene in a restaurant and being a little louder than he should be because he's practicing something for next week, or whether this is truly Larry. It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
Well, I can imagine it would be a little embarrassing when he's talking too loud or doing something inappropriate, and you don't know whether he's testing a performance or just being weird.
We've sat in a restaurant, a very sweet, quiet inn, you know, New England inn, with a lot of people with kind of blue-gray hair. And he came in late, and his back was to the entire restaurant, but we were looking at the entire restaurant over his shoulder. And he was whispering this story in a kind of stage whisper that had the F word in it a lot. And he basically cleared the restaurant. And then as he's walking out, he went, "Nice restaurant. Little too quiet for a Jew, but it's a nice restaurant," and walked out. And it's like, and you kind of have to walk in his wake going, "Sorry, sorry, sorry. You know it's Larry. Sorry."
And that's Ted Danson talking about our guest, Larry David. Okay, Larry David, you don't sound so inhibited to me.
I don't think that story is accurate. First of all, I'm not practicing anything at the table, as was alleged. Like practicing for the show, that never happened. But yeah, I was particularly taken aback at how quiet that restaurant was that Ted Danson was referring to. And so I made a racket.
Just stirring the pot, yeah?
Yes. It was disturbingly quiet in there.
So maybe not so inhibited.
Well, not in that instance.
All right.
Brian. By the way, the character has emboldened me to be much less inhibited and to take on a lot of the things that the TV Larry David does. If I'm at a dinner party and I want to go home, I can go before dessert. Okay, I've had enough. All right, I'm going to go. And nobody will be shocked to hear me say it, whereas I could never do that before Curb. And now people are not surprised, and they kind of expect it. But so that's great when I'm able to sort of emulate the character.
Larry David, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Larry David spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Larry David's new play, Fish in the Dark, opens on Broadway tonight. Jazz trumpet and flugelhorn player Eddie Henderson was in his 30s when he debuted on record with Herbie Hancock. Before that, he'd become a medical doctor who went on to specialize in psychiatry because it left his nights free to play the horn. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that decision is still paying off for him.
Eddie Henderson on First Light, a Freddie Hubbard tune from the 1970s. Henderson is a contemporary of trumpet aces Hubbard, Lee Morgan, and Woody Shaw, but he bloomed later and is still here to represent those colleagues who've all passed on. On Henderson's album Collective Portrait, he plays tunes by Hubbard and Shaw and one associated with Miles Davis, along with two of his own. Henderson has their kinds of virtues, effortless swing and offhand blues feeling, a fat, juicy tone and a lovely, warm lower register, and a gift for spinning an improvised tale. Using a Harmon mute without mimicking Miles Davis. One blessing of a long career is your voice gets more personal over time, despite lingering influences like Miles. Henderson's part-time frontline partner is another contemporary schooled in bebop phraseology and Coltrane's giant stepping harmonies, alto saxophonist Gary Bartz. Woody Shaw's Steeplechase Zoltan keeps Bartz on his toes, the tune and drummer Carl Allen. This quintet isn't a regular band, but Gary Bartz, Eddie Henderson, and pianist George Cables have been recording together since the 70s. Their easy rapport helps make this date a winner. Carl Allen and bassist Doug Weiss came to the fold later, but they can track the pianist beat for beat. George Cables on his tune Beyond Forever, another relic from the 70s. Back then, Eddie Henderson made a bunch of funky electric records, including a few of his own. Some jazz survivors have quietly put that chapter behind them, but Henderson's refreshingly upfront about it. He puts Cables back on that period icon, electric piano, for a couple tunes including Eddie's 70s standby, Sunburst. Carl Allen again stands out on drums. Eddie Henderson may never have quite gotten his due, but there's still time to correct that. His album Collective Portrait can only help. He showed up ready to play, and if he fluffs a note every once in a great while, it's a sign he's still taking risks at 74. Musicians and doctors and folks who are both will all tell you, playing jazz helps keep you young.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Collective Portrait, the new album by Eddie Henderson on the Smoke Sessions label. It's been 10 years since celebrated novelist Kazuo Ishiguro brought out his last novel. But our book critic Maureen Corrigan says Ishiguro's latest, called The Buried Giant, was worth the wait. Here's her review.
We know, but we don't know. We know that we'll lose those we love, that we're going to die, that the whole solar system will disappear one day. It's that shadowy state of knowing, but mostly living as though we don't know about all these looming terrors that Kazuo Ishiguro captures in his latest novel, The Buried Giant. No novelist around today beats Ishiguro when it comes to writing about loss, and almost every time he tackles his signature subject, he does so through the medium of a different genre. His breakthrough book, The Remains of the Day, is a straight literary novel in diary form. When We Were Orphans is a detective tale, also presented through diary entries, and Never Let Me Go is a sci-fi story. This time round, Ishiguro serves up a masterful blend of fantasy, Arthurian romance, myth, legend, and postmodern absurdity. In The Buried Giant, an exhausted group of medieval travelers cross a blasted landscape straight out of the plays and novels of Samuel Beckett. They can't go on, but they go on. And so too do Ishiguro's readers, through scenes infused with menace and magical beauty and, yes, unendurable loss. The two main characters here are an elderly couple named Axel and Beatrice. They live in an underground warren of dark rooms dug into a hillside. The candle that they would use to light their sleeping quarters has been taken away from them by their neighbors, maybe because of a fire, maybe just because of their age. It's hard to know for sure, because as our unnamed first-person narrator tells us, in this community, the past was rarely discussed. It had somehow faded into a mist as dense as that which hung over the marshes. It simply did not occur to these villagers to think about the past, even the recent one. Axel and Beatrice, though, like the other characters in this dim world, experience flashes of memory. Strange as it may sound, one day Beatrice recalls that she and Axel have a grown son, now living in a village only a few days' walk eastward. Old and infirm as they are, Beatrice and Axel set out. Here's our narrator again, describing the perils of such a journey. A traveler of that time would, often as not, find himself in a featureless landscape, the view almost identical whichever way he turned. A row of standing stones on the far horizon, a turn of a stream, the particular rise and fall of a valley, such clues were the only means of charting a course. Straying off course meant exposing oneself more than ever to the risk of assailants, human, animal, or supernatural. There were numerous instances of a traveler glancing back to the companion walking behind, only to find the latter vanished without trace. Along their tortuous way, Axel and Beatrice encounter pixies and ogres and other wanderers. A boy named Edwin, who's been cast out of his village because he's been bitten by a fiend. The elderly knight Gawain, arrayed in rusted armor astride his weary horse Horace. And a young warrior named Whiston, determined to slay the dragon that he believes is responsible for exhaling that mist of forgetfulness over the land. Of course, as is standard in these tales of enchantment, no one and nothing are what at first they appear to be. Axel, Beatrice, and their ragtag band of wayfarers take many wrong turns, but Ishiguro never does. If The Buried Giant were only a fantasy adventure tale, it would be well worth reading. But Ishiguro quests after far more profound mysteries here than the location of that dragon. Axel and Beatrice struggle to fight through the mist, to hold on to their memories and identities and each other, even as they have to resign themselves inevitably to letting go. This is yet another radiant and deeply moving Ishiguro riff on loss and the tragic nature of life. I'd pay it the tribute of saying that, as a novel, it's unforgettable. But as Ishiguro sadly tells us, that's only wishful thinking.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro. We hope you listen to and support your public radio station. And when you can't listen to Fresh Air on the radio, check out our podcast, which you can get on iTunes or your mobile podcast app. And of course, it's free. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.